Why do I conduct my show on this manner? Mundo!
Sweet mother of God, what is the holdup?
Eleanor!
Once again, something wonderful in my life has been turned into a giant crap fest.
Mundo!
Got a little bit more cock for you here.
Eleanor!
Bow tie boy got the big snaggeroonie.
Mundo!
Oh, stick to my nipples are tingling.
Eleanor!
See why America loves him so much?
Mundo!
I'd like to smash you in the face with my shillelagh.
Eleanor!
I have no idea what's going on.
Mundo!
He was lying.
He said he never tells a lie.
He was lying when he said that.
Eleanor!
I want a cup.
Well, could you spill that?
C-U-P. I want to see you. Oh, my God.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Stomach batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
For God's sake, strap yourselves down.
Yeah, that's right. It's the show your bosses don't want you to listen to. The show that's going to tell you the truth about what's going on in the workplace. So wake the hell up. It's the Cup of Joe radio show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Our engineer, Sock Puppet Sam, is here.
Glad to be here, Joe.
And we have a lot of stuff to talk about. But before we do that, Sam, give us the URL for the site.
That's cupojoe.blogspot.com.
And the email address.
joevec at bellsouth.net.
Okay, once again, I want to welcome all my fans listening in at the White Rose Society. My thanks to my good friend Ben Birch for hosting my archives there. Also, my listeners at rantradio.com. RadioPower.org, and CadronPictures.com. Okay, before I begin, let me say that my friend Dave Merrill and I are finally going to be putting together the special music show. And we won't call it the Cup of Joe Radio Show. It's going to be called Audio Hell. And it's really more Dave's thing than my thing, but I'm going to throw in the Disco Duck and Earache My Eye that one guy wanted, and Convoy and a few of the other goofy-ass songs that I have, and my friend Dave's got a few songs, too, that more than a few songs that he's going to throw in. So we'll get that done. It'll probably be a pretty long show, and I'm going to put that in a separate spot on the server, but it's going to be a fairly high-quality thing, so you might want to download it instead of trying to stream it, so because it's probably going to be maybe a couple hours long, and it's probably going to be it's going to be a high-quality CD quality, so I can you know, so you can really hear the music well, which is what you want. You want to be able to hear the music well. So, anyway, what was going on? You know, last weekend, by the way, I hope everybody had a good Memorial Day holiday. I had a very good time over the weekend. My wife and I went to see Shrek 2, which is a good movie. I recommend it. I was in a mood for prime rib. And I don't eat prime rib that often because it's, well, it's fucking expensive. But I had a few extra dollars. And I wanted to treat my wife to someplace nice because she usually doesn't eat at very nice places because, you know, she's been poor most of her life. And even though I've been pretty poor most of my life, I still take the time every now and again to treat myself to something a little fancier. And I was in the mood for prime rib, which I am from time to time. So we went on Sunday, and probably Sunday was a bad day because it was the middle of the holiday. And we were going to go to an Outback Steakhouse, but, you know, since I don't have a vehicle and I won't have one until next week, we couldn't go because the bus that normally goes to that spot wasn't running on Sunday. So, and of course, it was, you know, a holiday weekend too, but the bus wasn't running that day. So I went downtown Atlanta figuring there'd be a place, and there's a place called Durango's, which is right across the street from the Peachtree Plaza off Peachtree Street, which is like pretty much the heart of downtown Atlanta, but they were closed. And we went to the Hilton Hotel next door, and they had a steak restaurant on the roof, a rotating one, but they were closed. But there was a place called Morton's, which I hadn't heard of before, which apparently is a really, really fancy schmancy steak place. And this place was, it was very dark, and you can tell a lot of great business deals went in. It had a wall with all the celebrities and shit that had been on there. And And we had a prime rib there, and it was a little pricey. It was $100 for the two of us. And actually, we only ordered the one steak. The prime rib they had was like 24 ounces. And even I, and if you've ever seen a picture of me, you'll understand what I'm saying when I say even I cannot put away a 24-ounce prime rib. And actually, it was the first time I'd had the prime rib on the bone. Usually, they cut the bone off and just have the meat. I asked for it rare, and it came back a little too rare. It was really more like raw. And they came back, and they cooked, and it was a little cooked on top, and actually a little... You know, prime rib's got to be a certain way. And while this was very good, it really... It's not what I was used to from prime rib. But it was delicious, and I enjoyed it. And we had a dessert. And the dessert was particularly good. I had a chocolate cake that was different from any kind of chocolate cake I'd ever had before. It wasn't really like a cake, like a breading cake. It was more of a... I really don't know how to describe it. It was kind of like a mousse almost, but it was dark chocolate. And it melted in your mouth and had a kind of cherry brandy flavor to it. And it was absolutely delicious. Actually, the best chocolate cake I've ever had in my life, bar none. And I really, really enjoyed that. And I don't think we'll be going there again simply because it was so expensive, but we did enjoy it. Well, one of the things when we were walking downtown is we ran into a guy from the Libertarian Party who had the Libertarian Party had their convention in Atlanta this weekend. And I have a thing with the Libertarians. Quite frankly, I just laugh at them because they're so full of shit and they're such a bunch of fucking idiots that it's just kind of fun just making fun of them. And I actually did have a brief email exchange with the previous Libertarian candidate, Harold Brown. And it was about Pearl Harbor. And actually, it was kind of through somebody else who was interested in this issue. And I happened to be a little bit knowledgeable about Pearl Harbor because my dad is a Pearl Harbor survivor, and I did a little studying about it. And Mr. Brown is one of those people who believes that that Roosevelt intentionally kept the aircraft carriers away because they knew exactly what was going to happen and la-di-da-di-da and all this horseshit. And it's all horseshit. It's all horseshit from people who can't stand Roosevelt and didn't like what he did for the country, which was, by the way, make the country prosperous. Gee, what a fucking shock. That liberalism sure fucking worked, didn't it? The country was a prosperous country almost from the time he took over. Well, I wouldn't say that. It took a while for all this stuff to get through. But from the mid to late 30s all the way through to the 70s, this country was a prosperous country. And it's only until conservatism started having its resurgence that you suddenly started to have problems with a lot more poor people and all the wealth being sucked up to the top. But anyway, the Libertarians, they're their own little group, and they try to pretend that they're far more knowledgeable and shit than anything else. And they're all a bunch of bullshit. It's all a bunch of crap. I wrote this on the blog way back in October. We're talking about libertarianism in general. I wrote, libertarianism is a bullshit political fantasy. It's a political organization whose unifying principle is that you shouldn't belong to a political organization with a unifying principle. An organization whose members probably wouldn't be able to survive if it weren't for the underlying social structure built primarily by liberals. In other words, libertarians are freeloaders whose success in life came because liberals worked hard to ensure the rights and freedoms they supposedly worship. And I posted this on Daily Kos, who had a topic about the libertarian thing. And I got some interesting responses. I like one guy wrote, Al Fubar, which is a funny name. Fubar, for those of you who don't understand, is a military term, which basically means fucked up beyond all recognition. And he wrote, boy, that's way harsh, but you're basically correct. When I first heard libertarian arguments way back in college, I was intrigued intellectually, but something jiggled my bullshit detector. It's always been hard, though, at least for me, to put a finger on exactly what that something is. I guess it's the idea that you can have a society in which everyone acts with the self-absorbed independence of a Renaissance prince, yet no one will ever read the prince or get any ideas from it. That was a really good one. And one guy responded, said, our rights and freedoms are owed to liberals. I would have said that our enjoyment of our rights and freedoms is owed most of all to the Founding Fathers. And it seems to me that libertarianism is the current political philosophy that is the closest to the thinking of the Founding Fathers, especially to their Jeffersonian wing. And that was by someone named Lysias, L-Y-S-A-I-S. I'll have to do a Google search on that to see, because it sounds like a Greek person, and if it's a historical person, I want to find out about it. And I responded that the social structure we live in today was created by liberal New Deal Democrats 70 years ago. Liberal thinking and Keynesian economic theory were the predominant forms of thinking of American politics for 40 years. And even Republicans like Eisenhower and Nixon understood that the power of the federal government could be used to improve people's lives. It brought electricity to the rural South and many other areas. It gave U.S. soldiers after World War II the means to improve their own lives through the GI Bill. It treated Germany and Japan with dignity after the war and turned deadly enemies into loyal friends. The federal highway program was a huge boon for private businesses. The race to land the man on the moon created spin-off technologies that allow people like Lysias to make a fool of themselves in public forums. Now, the Republican Party has spent the last 30 years trying to undo that structure, and now the libertarians are out there saying that we don't need it. Shit, even Jefferson finally realized that you can't accomplish a damn thing if everyone has their own agenda and refuses to work together because it goes against their ideology. Why the fuck do you think he started what we now know as the Democratic Party in the first place? Wake up and smell the real world, dimbulb. Libertarianism is bullshit. If you libertarians want to prove to us what a bunch of rugged individualists you all are, haul your asses up to the moon and try your horse shit up there. My bet is that the last one there will have survived by eating the carcasses of the rest. Now, Big Red took exception to this. He said, newsflash, you need to read more actual history. Instead of spitting your putrid ad hominem attacks on libertarianism, you should read a great deal more and realize that libertarianism is, in fact, the very root of the Democratic Party. The sole reason the Libertarian Party exists is because liberals changed focus, instead concentrating on being the everything-to-everyone Federalists they've become today. You should be embarrassed by your contortion of the actual lineage of these things, and I suppose he had to look up the word lineage, but I'm betting your self-righteousness will prevent that from ever occurring. Rugged individualists? I mean, come on, if anything is bullshit, it's your third grade level of understanding of American history, chump. And I wrote back, basically, piss on you. If your fucking agenda is so goddamn good, why is it that you poll less than the fucking Green Party, you imbecile? Fuck you and fuck your worthless piece of shit party. Take Neil Bortz's cock out of your mouth for 5 minutes and taste the sea air. Your fucking 15 minutes are up. For the record, shit for brains, the Founding Fathers lived in an agrarian society. We live in an industrial technological society built by the sweat of working people, not a fucking fantasy world inhabited by fat-headed cocksuckers like you. And if you find my ad hominem attacks a little too much for your oversensitive ass, well, I've got the world's smallest violin right here, and I'm playing it just for you. In the meantime, go fuck your mother. Oh, I love it when I get subtle. Now, what happened at the Libertarian Party at their thing is it had three guys, basically, who were running. Some guy named Badnarik, some guy named Nolan, and some guy named Russo. And they were voting on that. And, of course, it's hard to get libertarians to agree on much of anything because, again, part of their agenda is everybody should have their own agenda, which is fucking ridiculous. What happened was, let's see, Nolan dropped out and endorsed Badnarik. And apparently it was a trip between – it was a feud between Russo and Nolan. So when Nolan dropped out, he endorsed Badnarik, and therefore Badnarik won. Russo, according to MyDD.com, and this is you have to just look for the Libertarium. It's by Jerome Armstrong. Russo, in his departing speech, took a swipe at Nolan, saying something like, "When I got into this race, I didn't know if it was as much about winning the nomination as it was about making sure that Nolan didn't get the nomination." Badnarik has no money and no personality. He's from Texas and all but assures that the Libertarian Party in 2004 will be no different from the Libertarian Party in previous elections. And some of the commenters here wrote, why the Libertarian Party sucks exemplified. Badnarik, this nomination embodies everything that's wrong with the Libertarian Party, a bunch of rigid ideologues apparently not too interested in building a broad pro-liberty movement. When Aaron Russo appeared on the scene, I was hopeful that 2004 might be different, that they might actually nominate someone with the potential for broader appeal, someone who has charisma and understands the need to emphasize the issues that resonate with people disgusted by both major parties. In other words, someone who gets it. Apparently, though, the Libertarians are happy to remain a fringe party stuck in their less than 1% voting range. Talk about opportunity squandered. Well, this pragmatic Libertarian leading voter has lost interest. I will probably now throw some money at the Kerry campaign, was planning on doing so anyway, since the thought of four more years of the Bush cabal in power, compassionate fascism, anyone, scares the crap out of me. When the election rolls around, I plan to write in Ron Paul for president, since I live in Bushistan, I mean Texas, and my vote counts for squat. And other people chimed in. You said my sentiments exactly. This is Jerome Armstrong. I actually came out of that experience watching the convention with a gladness that the Democratic Party didn't have a brokered convention. Badnarik held a majority in only two or three states for the first two rounds, and one of them was Texas, his home state. Russo gave a great speech at the end. Too bad it's his last as their voice. And I love this one from another anonymous post. Let's get our bearings here. Is the Libertarian Party convention the one where everyone is sporting Spock ears and learning to speak in Klingon? Or is that the other one where the conventioners are somewhat less in touch with reality? You know, I listen to Libertarians from time to time, and I talk to them, and you know something? They're all a bunch of fucking idiots. They're all a bunch of fucking stupid idiots. They're worse than the Green Party, and the Green Party is pretty fucking stupid, too. I've gone off on the Green Party a long time. You know, the Green Party is a fucking single-issue party. They're all environment and nothing else. And I don't even know what the fuck the Libertarians stand for half the time. When they say one thing, and then they turn around and they say something completely fucking different. God. Christ almighty fucking Libertarians. You know, you get a few of the kids on Rant Radio. Your kids on Rant Radio with your head and your clothes. You know, some of you guys are, you know, tend to tilt towards that. But you know what? You're fucking kids. You're still too young. I'm sorry, man. I don't mean to be rude, but you're still fucking kids. It takes years to develop a true understanding. Very rarely will someone less than 20 develop a true understanding of what the fuck is going on in the world. Very rarely. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. But it's very rare. And certainly none of those people are going to be hanging around on fucking chat rooms. You know, I go to the Rant Radio chat room when my show is on. But other than that, I really don't. Because, quite frankly, a lot of the kids there are just like, I'm like, whatever. Whatever. Fucking Libertarians. Fucking Greens. Sam, play us out.
We'll be right back with more of the Papa Joe Radio Show.
And welcome back to the Cup of Joe Radio Show. I'm your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Once again, the URL for the blog is cupojoe.blogspot.com. That's cupofjoe.blogspot.com. And the email address to write to me is joevec@bellsouth.net. And speaking of the radical middle, about a month and a half ago, I interviewed Mark Satin, who is the author of the book, The Radical Middle, Politics We Need Now. And that was about mid-May. And even though we talked then for almost 40 minutes, two 20-minute segments, we still didn't really get a chance to cover all the things that I wanted to talk about. So, we're going to go back to the telephone, and yes, I have my handy-dandy little telephone, and I've got it hooked up to the computer. It does change the sound somewhat, so the quality of the sound is going to change as we transfer over to the phone. You know, I don't spend a lot of money on this equipment. I'm not a high-tech kind of guy. Well, I am a high-tech kind of guy. I'm a low-money kind of guy, and I don't have a whole lot of money to begin with, so I kind of have to fiddle around and do things, but you'd be surprised at what you can accomplish with just a little bit of money and a bit of ingenuity and a bit of nose to the grindstone type of hard working ethic, like I'm a hard working regular guy. Anyway, here we go. Well, my voice is going to change as you're going to hear me say...
Welcome back, Mark Satin. Mark, it's been a long time, hasn't it?
Well, I remember vividly back when we were talking before. You were very, very opinionated, very lively, and it was just really enjoyable, so I'm glad to be back again.
That was way back on May 15th. Boy, it just seems like it just happened a few minutes ago.
Really?
I want to talk about something that we didn't get a chance to talk about the last time, and we started to talk about the workplace environment. But I really wanted to talk about the corporate culture, because the corporate culture, which is the way the government is run right now, as far as I can see, really permeates our society. And let's talk about that. And especially like companies like Enron, which is like the poster child for corrupt businesses. Let's talk about how that got started. Now, you asked the question in your book, how did Enron managers and vice presidents get to the top? You don't object to anything, one former Enron executive told Business Week magazine. The whole culture at the vice presidential level and above just became a yes-man culture. How serious a problem is that in this country?
Well, it's a terrible problem. I mean, we've seen in the Army when people carried out orders in the prison and tortured folk. Good people will do terrible things when they're part of an institution. It doesn't even matter what the institution is. I mean, I did terrible things when I was part of the New Left in the 1960s. It's too easy to say that people should be better, or if we just have some ethics, people will be better. I think that the problem with corporations in this country is not so much that they're capitalist, and it's not that there are bad apples in them either. I mean, there's bad apples everywhere, but they don't tend to dominate everywhere. I think the problem with corporations is the corporate culture, certainly in a corporation like Enron, is the root of the problem. And we need to direct some serious attention to changing corporate culture. And if we don't do that, if we pretend it can be solved by one stringent law that seems to slap corporate executives on the hands, we're marching down the wrong road.
Well, all this talk about
so is Ralph Nader. I mean, talking about the corporations are bad and we shouldn't have, you know, big corporations are the problem. I don't think that's true either. I mean, you can say that. I mean, wouldn't it be wonderful if we all lived in small communities of 5,000 people, and we all worked in little hand factories like we did in the 1830s.
Well, that's a little avoiding reality there. It's
yeah,
a different era.
The fantasies of the elite.
Well,
I don't care about that.
As a liberal, I believe in capitalism, but I also believe in regulation of capitalism. And I think the problem is that we've gone away from regulation of capitalism, and part of that has to do with the 1975 SUNPEC decision by the Federal Elections Commission. Are you aware of this ruling?
No. What does it mean?
It was back in 75. SUNPEC was a raisin company out in California, and basically, a PAC, of course, is a political action committee. For those of my listeners who don't know that, but basically, prior to this decision, corporations were not allowed to use their own money to fund their own political action committees. But this decision, which was in the wake of all the Watergate scandal, said, well, it's okay for corporations now to use their own money to fund and create a corporate political action committee. Well, before this decision, there were maybe 20 or 30 corporate PACs. Within 2 years of this decision, there were like 2,000 corporate PACs, and they were the ones who started flooding the government with their special interest money and basically began the process of corrupting the U.S. government. And I think we need to repeal that law, first of all, so that and we've talked about this in our previous thing about how we need to take corporate donations completely out of the electoral process. It should be all funded by individuals.
Well, yes. I mean, we need to take the contribution of all entities out and leave it entirely up to individuals. I would also have right on your tax forms a $50 tax benefit for anyone who gives $50 or more to either a political candidate or to a political party. What that would do instantly is mean that small people, any person could give $50, since it would be a credit on your taxes. Anyone who pays taxes, that is, could get that credit. And what it would mean is that people who don't have many resources would be giving in toto far more to political candidates than richer people.
And I think with the Governor Dean campaign way back when, one of the astounding things about that was not so much the amount of money that got raised for that campaign, a lot of good it did him, but the fact that it came from so many people donating so little money. I mean, you know, you look at the Bush machine, and they're basically getting $2,000 here, $2,000 there from different people. But since 2,000 is the limit, they're basically stuck on that. But when you get so many more people donating less money, a candidate can raise really, really huge sums of money just doing that, if they can, you know, get to a whole group of people. And I think that was a remarkable thing that, that Governor Dean did in that respect. Actually, it was more Joe Trippi than Governor Dean.
One of the sad things about this, though, is that I don't think you'll ever be able to get huge flows of money completely out of the political system. I mean, we're a nation awash in money, and we're a nation that believes that money is there to be spent.
Oh, sure. But I think we can change where it comes from, though.
There are many clever things you can do. I think free media is one thing. If a candidate, I mean, I wouldn't let any candidate get free media, but if you gather a certain number of signatures, or if you get a certain number of, say, $5 contributions, I do think that if you're running for office, you should get free media time. And that would make it infinitely easier for candidates who aren't hugely supported by big swaths of money, whether they come from the corporate right or from Ted Turner and George Soros on the left, to be able to get the free media time. I can tell you that a lot of radical middle candidates would not be supported either by the right or by the left. We're just trying to move beyond the traditional points of view, and we're trying to take the best from the left and the best from the right, but go beyond them. And that money would not be there for original candidates with original ideas, and candidates who think deeply in the long term about our problems.
Mm-hmm. Well,
getting back to corporate culture for a minute, I think there are several ways to work against negative corporate culture. One is simply by bringing in good consultants. There are marvelous good corporate consultants now who are doing good work in the corporations, and it's astonishing that their work isn't covered in the media. I mean, to me, many of them are doing at least as much good as some of the laws that are being proposed. Peter Senge, for instance, who talks about how a corporation should become learning organizations, where every member of the institution should at all times not only be informed of what the corporation is doing, but participate in groups that talk about how the corporation should be doing what it's doing. I think that's a marvelous idea, and it's being tried in some places, not very large places. But he himself is now consulting for many of the Fortune 500 corporations.
Well, you wrote on your website that the task of every good consultant is or should be to help executives achieve a balance between hard management, that is, designing a good product, setting the right price, and pursuing the right strategy, and soft management, which is ensuring that employees are connected and motivated to give their best. And
yeah, well, I am more articulate on my website than I am in person. I'm afraid that's true. That idea is from Dan Goleman, mostly. He's done not just the well-known book called Emotional Intelligence, but since then a large number of books about bringing emotional intelligence into the workplace. And he himself is like Senge, consulting with top corporations now. And if his ideas are adopted, it would be wonderful to see. By the way, Paul O'Neill, who is one of the few decent guys in the Bush cabinet, was well known for treating his subordinates well. And going down, I mean, he was well known for asking his secretaries if he could make them coffee. Now, consider the kind of corporate culture that comes out of. That's not the Enron corporate culture. You can't have chief executives operating like that, treating people equally, no matter what their station in the corporation, unless the entire corporate culture has been geared to support that sort of behavior.
Hmm.
It's just, I mean, to me, Alcoa under O'Neill was the opposite of Enron under Ken Lay. And you can call both of them corporate capitalism, but they're really like night and day. So I think it's too simple to say that corporations themselves are bad. Another way to change corporate culture, and it's less direct, but that may be even more substantial, is by changing certain laws. I don't mean punitive laws. I mean, for example, we should make it a lot harder for top executives to sell company stock while they're in management. I would even go so far as to say that that they should be forbidden to selling any stock in the company within 2 years after they leave the company, so that they won't consciously or unconsciously act to inflate the stock's value just before they go out of just before they choose to sell the stock. You just don't want to tempt executives with that. Another idea that was apparently too effective for Congress, for our Congress to enact, would be to impose lower taxes on gains from shares held for several years. So, and that what that would do would encourage investors to hold on to stock for long periods of time, so that corporate management would have a chance to think more in terms of what the company needs in the long term, and be less worried about the upcoming quarterly report.
Right. I think one of the big chimeras that's been running around, and of course it's perpetrated mostly by the right wing, is the whole tort reform thing. And I personally think that sometimes the only way to get a company to behave itself is to really hit them with nasty punitive damages, make them really pay in the pocketbook for abusive workplace culture and stuff like that. How do you feel on the subject of that?
Well, I have mixed feelings on it. I agree that without being intimidated, sometimes companies, especially companies with bad corporate cultures, will not do the good and right thing. You need to put the fear of God into them, just as you need sometimes to put the fear into common street criminals. So I agree with you there, but I do think that there are cases where it's gone too far. You shouldn't be able to routinely get tens of millions of dollars from companies just because they have just because they serve hot coffee. I mean, that's,
well, you know, that whole thing. Let me talk about that, because that's really one of the poster childs of the tort reform thing. But the reality of what happened was very different from the way that was played out. The lady in particular that they talked about, and this was a case where McDonald's lady got some coffee at McDonald's and burned herself on her lap. But the lady was not driving the car. The lady was a passenger in the car. And during the time of the lawsuit, McDonald's was already involved in several other lawsuits saying that their coffee was too hot. Plus, the damages that she requested and won the first time were drastically cut down on an appeal. So really, that was a case of the system working the way it should work. But that's neither here nor there, I guess.
Well, my point wasn't, I mean, I thought I implied that companies should be sued if they deserve to be sued. But you don't want plaintiffs all over the country. You don't want 30, 50, 100, 200 plaintiffs suing coffee shops because they have hot coffee that spills on their lap.
Mm.
It would be a nightmare. First of all, the price of coffee would go up. I think it's now around, what, $1.40, $1.50 at McDonald's.
Well, I think
not at McDonald's. At Starbucks, just for a cup of coffee. Somehow this system has to be reined in. But you do need the threat of punitive damages to keep corporations from acting in ways that are selfish and uncivil.
But what I also think is part of the problem is that, you know, regular working people like myself know that, you know, no matter how hard they work, because they're not in the right field or because they're not smart enough or not driven enough perhaps, are never going to earn a lot of money. And there's a lot of people think, well, if I make a quick lawsuit, you know, or if I can win the lottery, then my lot in life will improve, even though it won't necessarily improve because they simply have more money. You know what I mean?
Well, you've said it right. You've given yourself the critique right there. You don't want to have what's essentially a lottery for people who have access to a lawyer.
Mm-hmm. But if you give people the option of, you know, the ability to make more money themselves, they will be less inclined to go out and have these big lavish lawsuits, because it's only really recently that a lot of these come on. You didn't see a lot of it in the 40s and 50s and 60s. Simply because people, you know, working people were making a decent enough money that they didn't feel the need to say, well, the only way I'm going to see the kind of money that these big guys get is just to sue somebody or to hit the lottery or something, you know?
Well, that's an excellent point. I mean, you, all these ideas that I talk about from my book, Radical Middle, have to be thought of as one total package. If people had affordable health insurance that built in preventive and alternative care, for example, then people would be less desperate for money. if everyone could be assured of a job that paid a decent wage, as they would be under the system that I propose in my book Radical Middle, then people would be much likely, less likely to abuse what the system offers them.
And of course,
and
we have
and
to
so on, so on down the line. And by the way, if you total all the proposals in my book together, you will find that this country would save money. We would save money by having more intelligent public policies.
Well, it's always that way, though. But again, more intelligent public policy isn't necessarily what the public always wants. They get caught up in hot button issues and think about that only. You know, and unfortunately, it's just the way Americans are. I think sometimes they just, you know, they don't pay that much attention to what's going on, and when they do, it's usually for the wrong reasons. And it's an unfortunate truth, but I see it as the truth.
It is all true what you say, Joe. But you also have to fault the politicians and other leading lights in the society
and the media
for not
as well.
Offering coherent alternatives to what the far left and the far right and the mushy middle, what I would call the mushy middle, are proposing.
Well, you're not going to get a fair shake from the media, that's for sure, because the media is all part of that culture as well.
Now, there I'm not sure you're right. Many people in the media, I know for a fact, are deeply, deeply, deeply disconcerted by the way this country's politics are going. And I think if a credible political movement were to start along what I was calling radical middle lines, it would not be ignored by the press. It would be covered. In fact, there's already a think tank in Washington called the New America Foundation that gets extraordinary play both in the Washington Post and on C-SPAN. And that's your beginning, right? 1 year you're on C-SPAN, and the next year you're in newspapers, and the third year you're on, you know, your spokespeople are being quoted on national television.
Well, let's not forget the role of the blogosphere, too, in little radio shows like this. I mean, 15, 20 years ago, I could not do anything like this. Just a little guy like me had no way of spreading any kind of message around. Now here I am with a very simple computer. In fact, I have a very crappy old computer and the very simplest of equipment and program, and I'm able to put out a message to however many people care to listen to it over the Internet. And that's a wonderful thing. And, of course, bloggers like Atrios and Daily Kos have their own audiences, you know, and stuff like that. So I think the Internet is really starting to change things, and it's really beginning to make its presence felt.
I agree with you. Another thing that speaks well for our future is professional schools have begun to change. Instead of being bulwarks of reaction and the status quo, law schools, medical schools, business schools are full of exciting courses and full of exciting students who are there often because they're turned on to the idea of becoming expert and using their expertise to help build a better society. As you may recall from our last talk, I went to law school at mid-career, and as a result, I got to see it both before when I was in school in the 60s and after when I was in school in the 90s, and the difference was dramatic. The difference in the sense of possibility that students felt in the 90s, that they could actually take what they were learning and make the world better. It was palpable. You could almost breathe it. It was a very exciting 3 years I had in law school, and I just hope that those students are not terribly stymied when they get out.
Let's take this up to the next level. We've been talking about problems mostly in America, but really, we're living, and as much as some of the people on the far left might want to deny it, we're living in a globalist world right now. The Europeans are certainly, and I think it's extraordinary what they've accomplished with the European Union over the last 5 or 10 years,
yeah.
And especially since they recently added, 10 new countries to make, really, because now it includes a lot of the old Eastern Bloc countries.
Yeah, right up to the border of the Soviet Union.
And I think it's tremendous what they're doing, and I really do see that we have to have a global economy. I think eventually we're going to have one currency. I can't imagine how we can continue on with different currencies throughout the world.
And one language.
And I think,
or at least a common language.
I certainly would vote for English because, hey, it's easier for me.
And everyone uses it on the Internet.
Sure.
But wouldn't it be marvelous to be able to talk to people? I think one of the reasons we have so many problems in the world is we're not able to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose it was a matter of course that we communicated with Pakistanis, Iraqis, Brazilians, Japanese. Suppose we had continuous verbal intercourse with those people. We would we we wouldn't we wouldn't think of them as the other nearly so much. We just think of them as, you know, different from us, but maybe not that much different than people living extraordinarily different lives 3,000 miles away from ourselves in this country.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree wholeheartedly. I think communication is a powerful medium, and I think that's why the Internet is so wonderful, is that it starts to allow that. And then there are still language differences and language problems. I mean, a Japanese person, for example, doesn't necessarily understand all of, you know, the written English language. And on the other hand, English people or Americans and English don't necessarily cannot necessarily read Japanese or Chinese. But those things can be overwhelmed. But
yeah, especially particular if English is a common language. This is the reason why, unlike most people on the left, certainly, and even some now on the right, I'm a champion, a big champion of economic globalization. I think in the long run, not necessarily in the short run for all of us, but in the long run, this sort of integration will be good for all of us.
And I think it's inevitable.
Well, it we thought it was inevitable in the 19th century. It never really happened. I think people could stop it again if people become fearful, and most relevantly for this show, if we don't come up with public policies that make it easier for Americans who are hurt by globalization to find more jobs. For example, I would give everyone who's displaced because of globalization free access to top-of-the-line job retraining programs. I give them moving allowances. I give them temporary wage supplements. And, of course, many of the other policies in my book are relevant to people in this situation. A school system that encouraged lifelong learning would make us all less vulnerable to the sea changes that globalization causes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm all for, you know, anything that helps people improve their lives. Because, you know, I look at where I work for Siemens, which is a German company that has many plants here in America.
Yes.
And some of the union workers there have been there for like 35. In fact, there was one person who was there for like 44 years, which is older than I am. And I just can't imagine people doing that today in this economy and the way things are. But when you talk about globalization,
Or even being willing to do it.
I mean, I certainly, you know, I say to my coworker, I said, if I'm still here five years from now, shoot me, please. Because, you know, while it's a good job and it's a good, you know, the benefits are very good and the pay is much better than you would get if it was a non-union place, the fact of the matter is all you're doing all day is pulling stuff off online. It's the same thing over and over, and you're dealing with the same kind of BS problems you always deal with.
We're back to what you were talking about earlier, Joe. The communications revolution is finished now, and as a result, we all know, both in this country and all over the world, how everyone else lives. And so people's willingness to sit there and pick something up and put it in a box and pick it up and put it in the box and do that endlessly is just not part of who we are anymore as human beings.
Well, such jobs are still necessary, though. I mean, after a while, I mean, you have to have somebody who, you know, who produces these things and somebody who's... And there are people who actually rather enjoy that sort of thing, you know?
Yes. I think there will always be 10 or 20% of people who feel fine, just fine doing that, and we should let them do that. I think many of those jobs have, though, over the last 20 years, 20, 30 years, been done away with through technology. As a matter of fact, you have groups in Washington, centrist groups, arguing that 90 to 95% of the jobs lost in this country have been lost not to globalization, but to changes in technology, to technological improvement.
Right. One of the big words that's going around right now is outsourcing. And while I agree that it's certainly a problem that, you know, companies are moving to other places to hire people at, you know, $2 an hour and whatnot, that can also work to our advantage as well. I mean, I use Siemens as an example. Siemens is a German company. It's not an American company. So I personally am all for outsourcing for the right reasons. I mean, it's obviously cheaper for example, BMW to build a plant in Arkansas and make and distribute the cars there than it is for them to build them all the cars in Germany and then, you know, ship them over to the United States.
Right.
And we can do the same thing here, you know, I mean, but one of the things, and again, I'll talk about Governor Dean, because he, you know, even though, you know, again, he wasn't the perfect candidate, I thought what he was saying was why is it that General Motors can move down to Mexico and set up a plant there, but the United Auto Workers can't go down there and organize the Mexican workers,
right,
to give them the better benefits? And we really do need to have some sort of global labor standards that people are going to say. And when I talk about inevitable for a global economy, I don't necessarily mean within our lifetimes. I mean whether it happens a century from now or 2 centuries from now or 20 years from now. I still see that, you know, that the two options for the human race are basically blow each other into extinction or really evolve beyond that and understand that we are really one people, one race.
Well, unfortunately, I don't think we have 100 years. I think we better figure that out in the next 20.
Well, I agree there.
In our lifetime.
I think it was a damn shame that that Bush got in rather than Gore, because I think if Gore got in, things would be so much different and we would be talking and thinking about the future rather than, you know, dealing with all this mishigash that's going on right now.
Well, frankly, Joe, I'm not sure things would be very different if Gore got in. I think that their differences were largely differences of style and rhetoric. And I agree with you that it would have been better for Gore to be in, but for a different reason from you. If Gore had gotten in, we would bump up against the limits of liberal philosophy. And the conservatives would have nothing really to offer beyond what Bush is offering now. And I think if Gore were in, we might be more willing at this point to move toward what I'm calling radical middle, toward a taking of the best from the left and the right and merging them and going beyond both. I think now everyone is hoping that the Democrat and Kerry has not really defined his program, but everyone is hoping that because he's a liberal, because he's a Democrat, because he's not an offensive person, he'll have answers. And you can look back at his track record of 30 years in public life and say, if he has answers to the deep problems facing us, he's never expressed them. How can we think that he's going to solve or even begin to solve the issues that we have now?
That's the problem I have with Senator Kerry. Much as I admire his sense of duty to public service and you know his war record certainly speaks
that
for itself.
35 years ago.
Yeah. But still, you know, he's still been in the Senate and been in government for a long time, so obviously he has a commitment to that. But to me, it seems to be more about personal ambition than for any real vision of the future. And I think that the Democratic Party establishment, the leadership, is basically lacking in any kind of vision. I mean, but it takes a long time to build a real progressive movement. I mean, the original progressive movement started back after the Civil War with the Populist Party. And it took like 20 or 30 years for their stuff to get in with Teddy Roosevelt. And the stuff that Teddy Roosevelt talked about with his new nationalism, and by the way, that's my favorite speech of him, new nationalism. A lot of the things he talked about didn't really get put into place until 1932 with Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal.
Exactly. I remember reading it when I was a kid.
And wow. You know, it was remarkable the success that they had with the New Deal programs, because you look back at America and the prosperity was tremendous. Part of that was because of the war, but also part of that was because he really gave everybody a sense of community. And everything started to fall apart in the late 60s and early 70s. And, of course, now we're almost back to where we were in 1929, 28.
I agree with you, Joe. There's another parallel that speaks to something that's hopeful, which is that just in the last year or two, there have been a whole bunch of books published from the point of view that we've been calling radical middle. Not just my book, but there's Matt Miller's The 2% Solution. There's Bill Owens' Voice of Reason. There's John Avlon's Independent Nation. There's a couple of books by a guy named Ted Halstead. And all of these are getting good play. They're getting play in the media. They're getting play on radio and as well as newspaper and magazine reviews. And it seems like serious people in Washington and outside of Washington are beginning to come to grips with the fact that we need a new way of approaching our issues for the 21st century that does borrow from left and right, but does go beyond both. In that sense, I think a better parallel to this time isn't the late 20s, but the early 60s. You remember the early 60s when you had Michael Harrington's book on poverty and Jane Jacobs's book on city planning, and Paul Goodman's books on radically revising the education system. When you had the beginnings of what became, I don't want to say New Left because that typecasts it too narrowly, or it could even be a time now like what the conservatives had in the late 70s, when all of a sudden you had a flowering of books by conservatives pointing toward new points of view that eventually became caricatured as the Reagan Revolution. But when they were coming out, it seemed to promise something genuinely new. I think we're living through one of those times now. And so in that sense, I think we could say that maybe in 5 years, maybe when Kerry has spent his 4 years and everyone's dissatisfied with him, maybe in 5 years there'll come along a political candidate who does express these ideas. A woman from New York State, perhaps, or a McCain or Powell figure out of the Republican Party.
Well, you know, if Hillary runs, that she's going to so polarize the right wing. I mean, their hatred of her is so visceral.
Yes, it would be hard for her to be on one level a radical middle candidate. But her ideas, just as Giuliani's ideas, I mean, it would have been absurd for them to run against each other in New York, since they're so close in terms of what they actually believe. Perhaps if you wouldn't buy it from Hillary, you'd buy it from Giuliani or Colin Powell. And I mean, don't forget these latter two are McCain, Powell, Giuliani. Those three are Republicans. Perhaps in name only, they're really going after something more thoughtful and deeper. And I myself would put Hillary in that camp as well, but I doubt she'll ever overcome the image that was created for her under her husband.
Well, how likely, let's jump that up another level. How likely is it that moderates from both parties would be willing to abandon their parties and form a new one?
The credibility of a third party in this country is—it's never been credible. Even T.R., who is one of the most popular politicians in the 20th century, wasn't able to pull a third party off, and he was at the peak of his powers when he ran as a bull moose in the Bull Moose Party. He got what 27%, I think it was. He threw the election to the Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, the Democrat was not a bad man himself. It just doesn't seem to be in the cards unless the electoral laws change. By the same token, though, I think both traditional parties are empty shells. They're really vessels. Though both of them are dominated at the moment by their most rabid 20% supporters, 80% of the people in each of the political parties, I believe, are people who are open to constructive and thoughtful new ideas. And any Democrat or Republican that runs for the nomination who's able to present such ideas would have a good chance of winning the nomination. I think even your friend Mr. Dean, had he mastered the art of public communication before he ran for the presidency, would have had a much better chance of actually winning.
Well, what I thought,
because much of what he had to say, I mean, when you move away from his stance on the war, much of what else he had to say was really radical middle common sense.
Well, what really attracted me to him was not so much his stance on the war, but looking at his record as governor, he just, you know, he had a doctor's eye for these kind of problems. He says, well, what's the problem and how can we find a solution?
Yeah, there you go.
In Vermont in particular, you know, he understood how to work with the legislature, and even though he had a Republican legislature, he worked together very well. I mean, he got elected 6 times. I mean, that's saying something right there.
Yes, it is, and it's not an overwhelmingly Democratic state. Certainly not on the level of the legislature. I think this is just what I was trying to say. If we're able to put forward the attractive radical middle reconciling, original thinking, a person of integrity, a person of both principle and practicality that he was, he'd have gone much further than he did. But he'd have had to be a little bit more balanced on the war, and he'd have had to not speak so quickly from the hip.
Right. Well, again, you know, that's one thing that might play well in Vermont, but doesn't necessarily play in national politics. Let's go the other way. Let's just assume for the sake of argument that George Bush gets another 4 years. I refuse to say reelected because, as far as I'm concerned, he was never elected to begin with.
Well,
but that's another story.
I'm sorry. A little. You feel so harsh. I don't think much progress can be made. communicating with half the American people if we speak of them always with such contempt.
Well, I know, but I always speak as my personal opinion, so I don't try to force anybody else to believe that. But at any rate, if Mr. Bush gets in for another 4 years, I think it would be an economic disaster for this country simply because the rest of the world is going to say, well, obviously, you know, Americans approve of the sort of hubris and arrogance that's going on, so why should we deal with them economically? I mean, I've talked about this on my blog and gotten some people who say, well, we don't need Europe. We can be isolationists and do whatever we want. And I just think that's a total crap. In a globalist economy, we need trade and we need to work with the Europeans and the Asians because their economies are really starting to build up again. And how do you feel about that? Do you think that the American could just, like, totally block itself off?
I think that we not only could we not do that. I mean, economists have run the numbers and found that we can't do that. But even if we could do that, I think it would do great harm to us as a people. We're at a time where, with communications and transportation, technologies being what they are, the planet really is our home. It's our home in the same way that the United States was our home in the 20th century. We're one world now. They used to say that rhetorically 50 years ago, but it's true. I mean, we have as much in common. You or I also have much more in common with people who are like us in other countries than we do with people who are unlike us in this country. And we need to deal with that. We simply need to deal with that. Unless the countries, and one way of dealing with that is coming to grips with economic globalization and cultural globalization. And so shutting ourselves off from the rest of the world seems to me to be cutting ourselves off from who we are and whom we're becoming.
Right. Well, listen, Mark, it's been great talking to you. We've been going on for almost 40 minutes now. Let's leave it here. Let me again remind everybody of the website. It's radicalmiddle.com. And to go ahead and order the book, the name of the book is The Radical Middle.
The Politics We Need Now.
Politics We Need Now. And, Mark, I'll probably talk to you again in the future as events unfold and we move closer and closer towards the 2004 elections. And, you know, we'll probably talk about a bit more about all this stuff because this is all wonderful stuff and it's the type of stuff I like to talk about. Even though I identify myself as a Democrat, I'm really more of an anti-Republican than I am a Democrat.
Well, I named three Republicans and one Democrat when talking about who I might support, but I'm glad you still consider talking to me. If it makes you feel any better, Joe, there's a cup of coffee right next to me, and I've been sipping as we speak.
Well, actually, I do like Senator McCain, and I would like Colin Powell a lot better, except that I thought he carried a lot of water covering up for the Bush administration as far as...
You've got to be loyal.
There's loyalty, and there's this...
For that. I mean, McCain has been apologizing for Bush when he's had to also, and the Democrats do it for one another. That's just part of how the game is played.
Well, Colin, Mr. Powell certainly has a means to redeem himself, and you know, if he would turn around, he would be a person I would consider voting for president. And I think people like McCain and Powell would do good in administrations of any party.
I'm not saying that they're radical middle politicians. I'm saying that there's a certain sensibility, a certain willingness to listen to reason, a certain willingness to think freshly about public policies that we desperately need in Washington, and they would set a tone that would facilitate radical middle thinking, and they would probably bring some of the radical middle thinkers into their administration, and so I just think they would open us up in ways that none of the current candidates.
Well, what we'll do is we'll keep talking as the thing progresses, and I'll give you a call every now and then, and we'll just discuss. How things are going, and how we see the future coming along.
Great.
Mark, it's been great talking to you.
It's been fun.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And I want to thank Mark Satin for being interviewed over the phone and taking time out of his very busy schedule to talk to me. That's it for this episode of the Cup of Joe radio show. Again, I'm your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio. We'll see you next time. Bye. Joe Vecchio, the host of the Cup of Joe radio show, is proud to be a member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 2127. However, the views of Joe Vecchio do not necessarily represent the views of Local 2127, the IBEW, or its affiliate, the AFL-CIO. Please remember to support your working brothers and sisters and help keep the American dream alive. The Cup of Joe Radio Show has been a production of Jove Enterprises, Incorporated.